1-1 pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeout for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
Strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager, that just happened. Thank you very much.
Now, here's your host, Gary Hill.
And welcome back to the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast. Gary Hill here. Thanks for being here once again. Extra innings once again. Nine is not enough for this team. 3 days in a row of extra innings. This one, though, a tough loss to the Los Angeles Dodgers as the Mariners go down in game one of a three-game series in L.A. Boy, Oakland 2 games in a row, wild roller coaster rides, and the same sort of thing in L.A., an up-and-down ball game, and when it was all said and done, the L.A. Dodgers get the win. We'll have the breakdown of what was another crazy game. We'll go through it in just a moment, and you'll hear from the skipper. You'll hear from Mike Zunino. That had some interesting thoughts on what went down in the ball game. Also, Mark Simon's going to be here from ESPN, stats guru. He's fantastic, and we're going to go through all kinds of different topics. Defenses, defense numbers, hard-hit balls, hard-hit average, also his view of the AL West and where the Mariners fit into that. Good stuff on its way with Mark Simon from ESPN. He's been on before. He's fantastic. He'll be on again. So he comes up later on in the podcast. So glad you're here once again as we go through this ball game. Also preview the game tonight as the Mariners will go back at the L.A. Dodgers and try and even up this series. Before we get too far into this thing, though, there is something that I think is important to talk about at this point. With the Mariners 3-4, 2 games left with L.A. before they come home. One thing that I think is important to recognize is the Mariners are the only team in Major League Baseball that is starting this season playing 3 playoff teams from last year in their first 3 series. And I think that's important to point out. Playing the Angels in their first series, the team that won 98 games a year ago, more games than any other team in baseball. Second series of the year, playing the Oakland A's, who won 88 games last year, a playoff team in the American League. Third series, playing the Dodgers, who won 94 games last year and won the NL West. 3 playoff teams right out of the gates. No other team in Major League Baseball has to face that sort of schedule to start. So the way I look at it, especially when you consider Oakland for 3 on the road, Dodgers for 3 on the road, if you can be in the neighborhood of 500-ish, which you will be if you take one of the next 2 ballgames. You'll be 500-ish. I think that's a great place to be coming home, especially because I think we can all agree they're not playing their best baseball yet. And I think we all think that will happen at some point. But to come off this road trip, 3 with the A's, 3 with the Dodgers, of course the first 3 with the Angels, in the neighborhood of 500 with an off day heading into a long homestand, I think that's a great place to be, because then you have the Rangers at home for 3, you have the Astros for the 3 after that, another off day, and then the Twins who are struggling for 3 after that. So I think it's important to recognize that with this start too. I think 500 is fantastic, which means taking one of the next 2 ballgames. So we'll preview those games coming up, but let's get to the one last night. And, you know, it looked like the Mariners were going to put this one on cruise control, pardon the pun, but can you believe it? Nelson Cruz wasting no time at all with Robinson Cano on board.
There goes Cano. The pitch swung on. Well hit ball deep to right field into the corner. Puig going back to the warning track. Goodbye, baseball! Into the front row of seats, down the right field line. Nelly Cruz, his 200th career home run, and he tucks it inside the foul pole, opposite field, down the right field line. Home runs in 3 consecutive games. Nelson Cruz looks to the sky, and the Mariners have a 2-0 lead.
Number 200 in his career for Nelson Cruz. That's 28th among active players. He ties Brian McCann from the New York Yankees for 28th on the list. By the way, Robinson Cano is 26th on the list. He's got 218 career swats, so 18 ahead of his teammate Nelson Cruz, but not too bad to have two guys in the top 30 among active players in Major League Baseball. So Nelson Cruz with the big fly there to give the Mariners a 2-0 lead. It's also interesting to note, he's only hit a handful of home runs in his career in first innings. That's pretty rare. And doesn't go down the right field line all that often. I think 25 home runs down the right field line in his career. So out of the 200, which is pretty interesting. So Cruz gets the Mariners off and running. Two runs on the board right off the bat. Mariners on top, 2-0. James Paxton looking strong early. He held L.A. scoreless through three, and the Mariners would tack on a couple more runs in the fourth inning. As Cruz steps to the plate once again.
Here's a swing and a drive deep into the gap in right center field, and this one is gone. Goodbye, baseball. Low line drive. Holy smokes. Nelson Cruz. A Cruz missile. Just over the top of the wall in right center field. Career home run number 201 was a laser beam.
Do you hear the crack of the bat? Let's listen to, just listen. Listen to the crack of the bat. Man, I mean, you could hear it off the bat. That's something. Nelson Cruz going yard, three at bats in a row with home runs. At that point, he ties J.D. Martinez for most home runs in the American League with four on the season. And the Mariners weren't done. Kyle Seager would step up, and he would go yard going back-to-back with Cruz.
Here's the pitch. Swing and a drive. Deep to right field. Way back, going and going. Goodbye, baseball. Way back into the bleachers in right field. Kyle Seager with his second home run of the season. Cruz and Seager go back to back here in the top of the fourth inning. And now it's the Mariners 4, the Dodgers nothing.
Man, that thing was crushed too. Kyle Seager had the home run there. Also had a great play early in the ball game defensively, showing off that gold glove.
Paxton's next pitch, swing ground ball to enter the hole at short. Diving stop, Seager gets up, throws the first, and he got him. Holy smokes. What a play by third baseman Kyle Seager, robbing Howie Kendrick of a hit. Diving way to his left, spinning on that dirt. And he gets up and he fires a strike over to Logan Morrison just in time to get Hendrick.
So things looking great for the M's. On top 4-0 going to the bottom of the fourth, but the Dodgers would strike for three to get within one. But the fifth inning again, the Mariners, they continue to play long ball. Four times last season, they hit four home runs in a ball game, and they'll do it early on in this season with Dustin Ackley going yard.
McCarthy back with a 1-1 pitch. Swing and a drive deep into the gap in right center field. Will this be number four? It is. Goodbye, baseball. Dustin Ackley with the Mariners' fourth home run in this ball game. Into the bleachers in right center field for Ackley. How about this, folks? His third home run of the season. And this is game number 7 on the year.
Yeah, Ackley batting 353 on the year. Three bombs now for Ackley, off to a blazing start. Leading off, playing center field for the Mariners in this one. Unexpected lineup put out by Lloyd McClendon. But Ackley with the long ball there. What a strange offensive game for the Mariners. Six hits in the game, four solo home runs. They score five runs total with Cano on first. I guess that's about as efficient as you can be, turning just about every hit into a run, but 15 punch outs along the way. It was a Rob Deer kind of game for the Mariners. All or nothing, either long ball, K, and just a handful of hits along the way. But at that point, take a two-run lead there. But again, the Dodgers fight back in the bottom of the fifth inning.
The 1-2 pitch. Swing and a line drive into right field. Over as Cruz can't get to it. Drops in fair. A base hit. Gonzalez running third. The throw to the plate not in time. Gonzalez will score. And down to second goes Howie Kendrick on the throw to the plate. And the Dodgers have tied this game at 5-5 here in the bottom of the fifth inning.
Just when you thought you didn't have to worry about Howie Kendrick anymore, there he is coming up with a big hit there as they tie things up, and that's the way things would stay. The tough part is for the M's, and give James Paxton credit because he gives up five runs at that point, but Lloyd McClendon really no alternative with a short bullpen, a handful of guys unavailable for this one. So Paxton had to give him a little bit more, and he did. So give him credit. He ends up going 6 1/3, pitching into the seventh inning, which they needed in a big way. He does end up giving up 6 hits, 5 runs all earned, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts. What happened? He was rolling early. What happened in the last couple of innings? I thought Mike Zunino had some good insight on James Paxton and his start.
No, I mean, I thought he did a good job. I mean, when we had to go through that lineup the third time, he made some great adjustments. They waited him out. They got some good pitches to hit. And I think he may have left the ball a hair up that third time through. But, I mean, they just had some good hits and some timely hits.
And he was able to get back to it pretty quickly, it seemed like.
Yeah, I thought he did a great job. I mean, he mixed all his pitches well tonight. I thought he had a great changeup. I thought his curveball was sharp. And he had a good fastball command. And, I mean, they just, they're a good lineup. They just stuck around, fought pitches off, and were able to scrap runs when they needed it.
Yeah, I know he's a huge preparation guy. You guys have the meetings. Mm-hmm. Were they what you expected? Puig, you hear a lot about first pitch.
Yeah. I mean, they were pretty much what we studied. I mean, a few of their guys are really aggressive. A few of their guys are very patient. So, I mean, we sort of had that. It was pretty similar to our reports. And, we just had to make good pitches early in the count. And some of those guys were aggressive early and got some good pitches to hit.
It looked like you were trying to play into the aggressiveness late in particular, mm-hmm. especially with the breaking stuff that Austin had over there.
Yeah, I mean, that situation, you had to go and not give them anything really to drive. And I thought we did a good job there. I thought Olson did a good job of getting the one strikeout. I thought he threw Guerrero great. And, he called me out and he wanted to throw a changeup down to win. I thought it was a great pitch. We sped him up numerous times inside. And, it was just a pitch that he was looking out over and did a good piece of hitting.
What does it mean to you? Because, I mean, he's burying pitches in the dirt. There's a runner on third. What mm-hmm. does it mean to be able to give him that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy he feels confident with that now. I mean, he knows his stuff well, and he's confident. So it's one of those things where, when he knew he wanted to go to that pitch, I had the confidence in it too because I knew we had set him up for it. And I think you just got to tip your cap sometimes. It was a good piece of hitting.
I thought Zunino was putting on a clinic behind home plate, and you can see it. It is such a difference when pitchers know they can just bury a breaking ball in the dirt, and they know, even with a guy in third, that Mike Zunino is going to stay in front of it and not let the run score. I mean, it was happening time and time again. And it was just from his framing to his blocking ability, it was all on display. And there's a lot of room behind home plate at Dodger Stadium. A lot of room behind home plate. And I thought Mike Zunino had a wonderful game behind home plate. So credit Mike Zunino there. Now, what did James Paxton think of his start? Here he is.
Yeah, I was feeling good, and I left some balls up there, made some mistakes, and they capitalized on it.
You come back after those and you have the 1-2-3 inning. What were you able to do?
I was just trying to keep it there for us, give us a chance, and just trying to put up a zero after those two bad innings there.
Was it any one pitch in particular, or was everything just kind of up on that, or was it your fastball?
It wasn't any particular pitch. I was just leaving balls out over the plate those two innings. The cutter to Peterson there, left that up over the plate. And you hit that ball well. And, the next inning, it was the first pitch changeup to Puig that he hit out. Just making some mistakes over the middle.
The Peterson one's kind of sting. I mean, that's the one that's left on the left. That's one you got to get right. You got to get him there.
Absolutely, yeah. That was a big mistake. I was trying to go low and away, and I left it up and away, and he stuck the bat out there and got that hit. So that one hurt.
Puig has hit the majority of his home runs in the majors so far on the first pitch. Was that in the report you guys got on him?
Yeah. I know that he's a first pitch hacker, and I just left that change up over the plate there. I was trying to go down and away, and left it up a little bit for him.
So there the explanation, and we would go to the 10th inning, third game in a row in extra innings. Dominic Leone pitching really well, coming up from AAA today with Wilhelmsen going on the disabled list, and Leone stretched out. He goes 2 1/3. He ends up getting tagged with the loss, but he pitched well, one earned run, a couple of walks. And it looked like with the bases loaded and one out, it looked like Tyler Olson on again. And, I mean, look at the situations he has been in already. in just his young career against the A's, you know, getting a win in extra innings, and then again pitching in extra innings against the LA Dodgers and coming up with a monster strikeout, and it looked like he was going to sneak out of the mess in the 10th inning.
Here's the stretch, and again the 1-2 to Crawford. Swing and a miss, and a curveball down and away for strike three. Holy smokes, the kid out of Gonzaga throwing that big sweeping curveball, and Crawford spun around inside the batter's box. That pitch was way low and outside, and Crawford chased it.
He continued to go to the breaking stuff, but then pretty good pitch, I thought, on the outer half of play, maybe caught a touch more of the plate than he wanted, but still not a bad pitch. But Guerrero wins the ball game, taking the pitch into right field.
The left-hander's 2-2 pitch, swing and a line drive into right center field. A base hit. Here comes Ethier on to score, and this ball game is over. The Dodgers win it by a final score of 6-5 here in the bottom of the 10th inning. Alex Guerrero with a line drive single into right center field, scoring Ethier.
Yeah, tough loss for the Mariners. 6-5, they go down in 10 innings, especially when you consider a 4-0 lead. And with this pitching staff, you don't expect that to happen very often. But the Dodgers, they can be explosive. And they certainly were in this ball game, coming all the way back and getting the victory. Brandon McCarthy, starter for the Dodgers, had such a strange pitching line when you look at it. 7 innings, 6 hits, 4 of them home runs, because of 4 home runs, 5 earned runs, didn't walk anyone, and struck out 10. Just a crazy line, and just another crazy game, third one in a row. This time, though, it goes against the Mariners as they fall. After the ballgame, the skipper, Lloyd McClendon, here's his thoughts on what went down in this one.
Just started to elevate the ball, and that's not like him. And really gave him a chance to get back in the ballgame. So it's tough. We wasted a lot of good performances tonight.
The effort from Leon called up today to get you to that point even.
He did a tremendous job for us. He knew going in that he would be stretched tonight if he came in. So, and he was up for the challenge. I thought he did an outstanding job for us.
Offensively, it was all or none, especially when their starter was in today. What were you seeing?
Well, I mean, we had good at-bats. I mean, I thought our guys were aggressive in the strike zone. We got some pitches to drive, and we drove them. I don't apologize for home runs. I kind of like them. So.
There were some strikeouts, too. Was that the aggressiveness? Is that kind of
a... Yeah, you know, you're going to have a combination of those from time to time. But all in all, I thought we had pretty good at-bats.
Hey, Lloyd, on the play where Van Slyke moved up to second, you left the base uncovered. Who should have been there?
Well, Miller should have been there. He knows that. It was a mental mistake. He was looking to be cut off at third, but in that situation with who's on second, you're not going to get him at third. He should have been covering second there. Cost us a run. Cost us a run, but it didn't cost us the ball game.
Bullpen-wise, are you a little cleaner now going tomorrow?
A little bit, yeah. We're a little cleaner.
Yeah, Medina warming up there.
Medina was up, yes. Could have, yeah. Hell, I could have gone. So, highly unlikely, but yeah.
Nelson, that's 4 homers in 3 games. So he's just giving everything you want and looking for.
Well, he's finding his groove. You know, he's swinging his strikes. You know, and he's getting pitches to drive, and he's taking care of them. You know, I think early on, he was probably trying to do a little bit too much. But I think he's settled in. He's comfortable now.
So that's the good news. The bullpen should be in better shape for tonight, although I think they're still looking for a good start from Hisashi Iwakuma as he looks to bounce back after a rough first start against the Angels. He went 6 innings, 9 hits, 5 runs, 4 earned. A lot of that damage coming early, and he really settled down and gave the Mariners 6 that day. So he'll look to bounce back. And the Dodgers, it's a spot start for L.A. It was suspected it was going to be Scott Baker. It's not going to be Baker. They are going to go to the minors and pull up David Huff from Oklahoma City. Huff has bounced around for a long time, left-hander out of UCLA. He kicked around with Cleveland from 2009 to 13, and then last year spending time with the Yankees and also with the San Francisco Giants. It really, for the first time in his career, found consistency with the Yankees out of the bullpen last season. 39 innings of work out of the pen in 30 games and a 1.85 ERA, a whip of 1.31, 28 strikeouts in 39 innings. But beyond that, he's really been up or down, and he's been in a starting role for most of his career, especially going back to college and the minors as well, and his time in the majors. With the Yankees, that was the first time he'd really been in a primary relief role, and he's going to get the spot start for the Dodgers. We'll see how long he'll be able to go. So lefty on the hill, and we'll see what the righty lineup looks like, of course, without the DH. So it should be an interesting lineup once again. First pitch at 7:10 from L.A. as the Mariners try and even up the series against the L.A. Dodgers. Right now, special guest, a chance to visit with Mark Simon from ESPN, a stats guru there. Good stuff as always, and here it is. Well, now we get a chance to talk to one of my favorites to talk to, Mark Simon. You know him from ESPN. You can follow him on Twitter at MSimonESPN or MSIM on ESPN. You have the old Milwaukee Brewers logo of Twitter handles. Is it an M? Is it a mitt? Is it an MB? Is it a mitt? It's either. It goes either way. ESPN Stats and Info, ESPN Stats and Info blog. Mark, thanks a lot for the time. We certainly appreciate the visit.
Happy to chat stats with you. Happy to chat with you anytime.
Is this a tough part of the year for you? I mean, we get our first data of the season, which is fantastic after all this time. We get numbers, we get box scores, yet it's so little that it's hard to draw conclusions from. Is it difficult to walk that stat line early in the season?
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to overreact to anything. Small sample size prevails for just about everything, although it's funny. I was looking at something today that said that, and we might get to this later, that Kane and Simmons have been the best defensive players in baseball this year, and that's one where that might hold up for 170 days, but most things don't. I mean, you look at guys like, who could have predicted Mark Canna on Oakland, some of the other things. Who could have predicted that the pitching would be this good in the early part of the season?
Is there anything that's happened in this first week beyond a couple of defensive players you mentioned? Is there anything that's happened in this week that you think can last?
I thought that the Tigers were going to be pretty good. I didn't necessarily think they were going to start 6-0. But even with the loss of Scherzer and the loss of Porcello, I felt that Verlander was going to bounce back, even though he's been hurt. I feel that they're very strong at the top of their rotation with David Price, Shane Green, and Anibal. They still have Cabrera. They still have Kinsler. They have Cespedes. They have J.D. Martinez. They have Victor Martinez. They have a very tough lineup. I don't want to say 1-9, but like 1-7. And in an age where pitching has been so good, I think they're going to be one of the better offensive teams in baseball. They're not going to hit 350, but they're 6-0. I don't think it's unreasonable for them to have been 6-0 at this point. It doesn't surprise me. I would expect a couple of six-game winning streaks for them this season.
And, of course, Detroit's going to be one of the teams in the mix in the American League. Mariner fans hope that the Mariners will be one of those teams in the mix in the American League. How do you view this Mariners team early in the season?
I seem to be in the minority on this. I went through my picks this year, and I said I can't just pick everybody that seems to be the consensus pick this season. And I have to pick someone to falter a little bit below the expectations that have been set for them. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and I said, is that Toronto? Is that Chicago? Is it the White Sox? Is that the Cubs? And I settled on Seattle. I think I picked them for 79 wins in the preseason pick stuff that we do. I think the reason for that was I felt a little iffy still for the rotation beyond Felix and Hitachi. The bullpen I was also a little uncertain on, even with Rodney on the back end. He's not perfect, as I guess you guys have seen this year. And the offense, even with adding Nelson Cruz to that lineup, you're still playing a couple of guys that I don't think I would play. You're relying on someone like Ricky Weeks, potentially, which I don't particularly like. And I don't think Nelson Cruz is going to replicate 40 home runs again. And you're asking a couple guys, too, that had career seasons, like Kyle at third base, you're asking them to replicate that, and we don't know that they're going to be able to replicate that yet. It's very much a wait and see for someone like him.
So who are, you mentioned a couple of guys there. Who are a couple others that, if things go right for the Mariners, need to play well, need to have big years?
Well, Robinson Cano can hit 120 through the entire season. I think what Seattle's season will come down to is whether Paxton gives them a consistent 30-start number three starter. I think it will come down to whether Tawan Walker can pitch for an entire season and throw 160, 170 innings and not force the Mariners to have to go to their sixth and seventh and eighth guys, and he certainly struggled that first start. I really think, and it's going to be up to Felix to stay healthy, and I know that there was some concern after he got pulled after five. I think they are a team that in the end, if they do win it, it will be because the pitching staff had a top two, top three ERA, more so than the offense coming through for them.
How do you see the rest of the division stacking up? It's pretty interesting, obviously, with Oakland and the way they turned over the roster. The Angels, are they as good? Astros, maybe a slight step forward, maybe not. And the Rangers and their health questions. How does the rest of the division look in your mind?
I think there's a lot of parity. I feel that the Angels are the best team. I would have picked them at the start because of Pujols and because of Trout and because they're going to get Garrett Richards back. And their starting staff, if it's fully healthy and fully functional, isn't necessarily that far behind a team like the Tigers with Wilson and Weaver and Shoemaker and Hector Santiago, who I think can be a lot better than he is. They have the closer at the end of the game in Houston Street. I've given up trying to predict the A's because whenever you try and predict the A's, Mark Canna comes out and hits 500 for a week. And I mean, who would have thought that something like that a 26-year-old would come up and suddenly be a superstar for a week? So I've given up trying to predict them. If they win 85, it won't shock me. If they win 75, it won't really shock me. They're starting a couple of guys at the back end of the rotation that are a little iffy to me. But they have Sonny Gray and Kazmir at the top. Mm-hmm. Both those guys dominated their first couple of times out. Gray in particular and Kazmir with his one start. So I'm looking at the Angels and the A's as being, top two with the Mariners behind them. I think Houston's going to be a lot better than people think. I don't necessarily think they're a 500 team, but McHugh and Keuchel is as good of a top two, potentially, if they're both healthy, they both make 30 starts. I think they can be as good of a top two just about as there is. They'll be that one that gets called the unheralded top two in the top two pitchers in baseball. Feldman's not a bad number three. They're bad at the back end of the bullpen. They still have some holes in their lineup. Chris Carter makes me very uncomfortable to watch. But I think they're a 75-win team, and I don't know what to make of the Rangers at this point because they seem like a MASH unit, and they could be headed for a rough season. So I guess I would go the Angels and A's, the Mariners maybe a hair behind Oakland, and then Houston a touch behind them with the Rangers at the bottom of the division.
Visiting with Mark Simon from ESPN Stats and Info. And I love your stuff, your statistical breakdowns, all kinds of different ways. But let's talk about your hardest hit rate that you talk about all the time, which is really, really great stuff. And for those that didn't hear our conversations last year, give us a little thumbnail of what you do in terms of hard hit balls.
Sure. There's a couple of companies actually that track this. They provide data to teams. Inside Edge is one. Baseball Info Solutions is another. And what they do is they rate every batted ball, and they may rate it on something like a 1 to 9 scale, where 1 is as softly hit a ball as you can get, and 9 is as hard a hit ball as you can get. And they break it down where 1 to 3 is soft, 4 to 6 is medium, 7 to 9 is hard. And they have a system of rules by which they determine what's a hard hit ball and what's a medium hit ball and what's a soft hit ball. They're looking for trajectory and velocity and whether you made contact with the barrel of the bat. They'll slow the video down to check that out. And what they give you in the end is what amounts to a hard hit average, where how often in this guy's at-bats or this team's at-bats is the guy or the team hitting the ball hard, making good contact, that 7 to 9 score on their at-bats. the good players tend to have the highest hard hit rates. It's not necessarily always so, but it tends to go that way. And the bad players, some may have low hard hit rates. There may be some situations, though, where a guy is struggling, but he's hitting the ball hard a lot. A couple of years ago, Victor Martinez comes to mind. He was drilling the ball all over the place, but he was hitting fly balls into the gaps at Comerica, and they were getting caught. And as a result, his batting average for the first 3-4 weeks of the season was about 180, but he was a top five guy in hard hit rate. And it's Victor Martinez, and he's likely to continue to hit the ball hard. And he did throughout that season. And the more he hit the ball hard consistently, the more that batting average came up, because the guy that hits the ball hard as often as he does isn't going to be a 180 hitter. So it's a good way to find guys that are aberrations, to find guys that are struggling who maybe will snap out of it as well, because any hitter will tell you what they look to do when they get to the plate is try and hit the ball hard somewhere. And if a guy is successful at that, chances are he's going to be a successful hitter overall.
It's such a useful number. For example, you know, this first week of the season, you watch Robinson Cano, who looks like he's driving the ball all over the place. The numbers don't back it up, but then you look at your hard hit rate, and I forget where he landed on it in the ones you put out today, but I think it was top 30, but it just backs up what you're seeing. Like, he's hitting the ball hard, just not getting the results yet, but you think they'll happen.
Right. A guy who hits the ball, a guy who registers one of those 7-9 scores on their balls, you have about a 70% chance to get a hit. So if you hit a couple of line drives in the first week of the season that get caught, that's not going to happen all season. If you're going to continue to hit the ball consistently hard like a Cano, you're going to wind up hitting 300, 290, 310. So, again, in the middle of the season, a slump like that goes unnoticed, but because he's struggling at the start of the year, people might panic and say, what's wrong? When in reality, there's nothing wrong with Robinson Cano.
Did you identify any players coming into this season in terms of a bounce back who, using that number, may hit for a higher average, may produce a little bit more this year compared to last year?
I'm trying to remember who fell into that. I know for pitchers, you'll laugh at this. Well, it's not funny, but the guy that I was like most looking forward to this season was Marcus Stroman of the Blue Jays.
Oh, yeah.
Because his ERA and hard hit didn't jive. Like, yeah. Guys with his hard hit were among the best pitchers in baseball. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to get him on my fantasy team. I'm going to steal him a little earlier than everybody else is. And then sure enough, he tears his ACL and gets hurt. In terms of hitters, it's weird because when you look at offensive numbers, you see some guys whose batting averages are held down a little bit by shifts. Like someone like Edwin Encarnacion hits the ball very hard, but his numbers are a little lower than most of the guys who hit the ball hard. Big Poppy would be another one. If he can get the ball through the shifts, it wouldn't shock me if he hit 290 to 300. And that sounds kind of funny because everyone thinks of David Ortiz as such a dangerous hitter. Funnily, I know I said earlier that, you know, you don't know that you can count on Kyle Seager. Last year among batting title qualifiers, he actually ranked 15th in hard hit average. And the guys that are above him, for the most part, are 290 and 300 hitters, and he only hit 268. So maybe if he catches a few more breaks or he's stuck in a bad ballpark where you can hit a lot of fly ball outs that are hard hit balls. If he was playing somewhere else, maybe he would be a shot at a 300 hitter. Adam LaRoche would be another guy whose numbers could come up a little bit with a little bit of good luck. And even Dustin Ackley. Dustin Ackley last year was top 30 in hard hit rate, but only hit 245. So don't quite just give up on him yet on the offensive end, although I know some people probably have.
He's off to a good start this year, though. Mariner fans certainly like to see that.
And there you go. There's your payoff. And now it's just a matter of it staying up for the whole year.
Yeah. I want to ask you about defense, too, because I know you follow the defensive numbers closely. There's a few different metrics that have popped up. What's your favorite in terms of what you look at in terms of defense?
So what we use at ESPN is a stat called defensive runs saved, which was developed by this company, Baseball Info Solutions. And if you use that or you use UZR, there isn't that much of a difference between the two. But what they do is they take batted balls and they look at how often each type of batted ball hit to a certain location is turned into an out. So it's almost as if the field is turned into a grid, and they can tell you at any spot on the grid how often a play is made depending on how hard the ball is hit. So it allows you to kind of separate a shortstop or a third baseman or a second baseman who's making plays on really difficult ground balls or line drives or making running catches on pop-ups, where they'll get a bigger reward for getting to a ball that's hit in a more awkward position for them to get to, which I think probably it helped a guy like Josh Donaldson last year, and a lot of people will say that he should have gotten the Gold Glove over Kyle Seager. The other thing that is tracked by a company like this is throwing arm accuracy, and that's factored into defensive run save, certainly. And Kyle Seager was basically the most accurate throwing third baseman in baseball, which is why I think he wound up winning the award. But the thing that's nice about it is it combines all of the different factors in a position-specific form to allow you to figure out a player's true defensive value. It's not perfect, but it's better than fielding percentage or something like that.
Right, yeah. There's just so many variables. It's hard. Like, how do they account for guys playing different positions? You know, some center fielders like to play in, some play deep, the shifts are on at some time. How do they account for all of those different factors?
Right. You have to know kind of going in that sort of thing happens, and you have to understand that the number that they give you at the end in some cases may be a little inflated or deflated, or it may be due to something like positioning. Where is the coach playing them? What kind of jumps are they getting right off the bat because of where they're playing? If you get a guy that's playing consistently in the left center field gap as an outfielder, and he's having to try and chase a lot of balls down because he's playing out of position, that's going to hurt his overall rating. But then there are some guys that are going to be very much helped by that. Johnny Peralta is a good example on the Cardinals, that if you look at his defensive stats, you would think he was some sort of a defensive whiz, like an Andrelton Simmons or someone, an elite shortstop. He's not. He just happens to be in the right spot for just about every ball that's hit his way, and he makes the plays. He's able to make the plays on the balls that he's able to get to, and the person you really have to give the credit for Johnny Peralta is someone like Jose Okina, their infield coach. Mm-hmm. And in the Mariners' case, the play of Kyle Seager and some of the other guys, Cano, I think you have to attribute a lot of that to the defensive coach, too. They talked about that. Kyle Seager talked in particular about that last year with how valuable Chris Woodward was for him.
Yeah, absolutely. No, Chris Woodward and Andy Van Slyke, too, for the outfielders, I think have made a big difference for this Mariners team and shouldn't be underrated. Now, great stuff, yep. Mark, as always. Before you go, I've got to ask you about this. So you write about the Mets a lot. You blog about the Mets a lot. But you're writing a Yankees book. Is that true?
Yep.
Okay. What's the book going to be about?
It's going to come out next spring. As a lover of baseball statistics, I decided to take on a challenge over the course of the next year. Triumph Books is doing this series of books. They might get around to the Mariners eventually, where they're taking a team's history and they're telling the team's history through the use of numbers. So for the Yankees, the numbers are things like 56 for Joe DiMaggio and 61 for Roger Maris. And each chapter is about a specific number, and the book's going to have about 60 chapters. I came up with the idea for one chapter that's going to be called Bridge to Mariano Rivera, and it's going to be the number of pitchers who got a hold in games in which Mariano Rivera got a save. And I happened to talk to a former Mariner today about it, actually, Jeff Nelson. Oh, yeah. He was a good interview. He was very lively, and I had a stat for him that I liked that I think Mariner fans would appreciate. Derek Jeter, he owned Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter was 0 for 8 in his career with 4 strikeouts against Jeff Nelson, so he had a good laugh about that and explained how Derek Jeter, he used to tease Derek Jeter when they were teammates that he could always get him out.
Oh, yeah, Mariner fans remember Nelly well. He was so tough, especially a right-handed
yep.
hitters. And boy, that I have never seen a combo. The Arthur Rhodes from the left side, the Jeff Nelson from the right side in the early 2000s, particularly 2001 with Sasaki closing. That was such a dynamite combination that was so tough on teams late in the games.
The Yankee fan will tell you that the Nelson-Stanton combination is the best that ever lived.
Yeah, that was a great one, too, leading up to Rivera. That was tough to beat, no doubt about that. Well, Mark, great stuff as always. We'll talk to you again soon. Again, Mark Simon, M. Simon ESPN on Twitter. Great follow. I recommend it. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld follows him. You should, too. ESPN stats
and
info, the blog. That's the place to go. Mark, we'll do it again. I always think it's a good time.
Yeah, absolutely.
See you later!